I'm dying. Start the episode with me fully in tears.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Thank God my face turns red almost instantly from me laughing. Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Obojima podcast, where we cry only sometimes. welcome back to the podcast. If you aren't familiar, this is our writer's room that we decided to record because, again, three white dudes desperately needing to start a podcast. I'm kidding. I forced this on them. They didn't ask for this.
That's true.
This is where we talk about Obojima and the world as we write about it. And we are taking you along for one of our actual writing meetings where we are going to talk about a continuation of last week's episode, the Nakudama and player backgrounds, which is the continuation of races and other things like that. If you haven't watched that episode, you should go jump into it. It's very cool. We talk about the Dara, which is a fun new race for Obojima, as well as elves and other fantasy races and such like that. So this time around, I want to jump straight into the Nakudama, and I feel like I should tee it up to Ari, because I feel like Ari was the most excited about the Nakudama. Just a smidge.
I remain the most excited.
That's right.
Yeah. Seeing images of Nakudama immediately, like who they were, kind of like sprung into my mind.
Yeah.
Our conversations, we all kind of fell into that same space with them about what they should be for Obojima and kind of just how they fit into the ecosystem. Nakudama are the oldest inhabitants of Nakudama are the oldest inhabitants of Obojima. They are a very we love the idea that they are this so they're kind of a frog-like people.
Yeah.
But they're also the kind of most exuberant and kind of naturally excited about the great things in life. So if there is a great meal to be had, they will seek it out. If there is, you know, if there's the best, like the finest whiskey in Obojima, they will find this thing. They love the good life. You know, you'll find them all over the island. There's not like really Nakudama enclaves or settlements. We discussed early on this idea of having kind of a very cosmopolitan kind of vibe for the island that Nakudama and humans and, you know, and elves and more recent arrivals of the Dara kind of living in these communities together. But yeah, we play this idea that Nakudama are the earliest inhabitants. And so when you get to older places on the island, the architecture will reflect Nakudama style. It might be close to water. Obojima itself is an island and there are rivers crisscrossing it and, you know, big lakes and things. And so you'll come across, you know, ancient Nakudama ruins and architecture and things like that.
Yeah.
And this idea of them informing Obojima's culture was something that we just, I still find really, really fun.
Yeah.
And what else can I talk about them?
Well, there's something I can jump in here really quick.
Please.
As you were saying something, I realized they're kind of like extrovert hobbits in the sense that, like, we want the best food and the most comfort and all the things, but we're willing to climb a mountain to get it.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, crazy.
Yeah.
They're like, if the Dara want to learn information and gain experience, then the Nakudama are the people who want the comforts that the Dara could care less about. The Nakudama will go and become a blacksmith, not because they care about learning how to be a blacksmith, because they know at the end of the road, they'll be able to trade their highly honed in hammer for like the best bowl of ramen or something like that. Or I don't know why I use ramen for every description. The best boba tea.
If you want to know where the best bards are playing, if you want to know, you know, the best inns to stay at on the road, Nakudama, they'll tell you.
Yeah.
Also, like the Nakudama, like wanna feel it. Like they want to taste things. They want to eat the stuff. They want to. They're kind of in some ways in the moment. I don't know if going so far as to say a hedonist, but they have that tendency of like they want to experience it.
Yeah.
And so like the Dars. The Dara's like call to adventure is sort of to like learn about things and to gain knowledge, whereas the Nakudama's call to adventure is to experience. They want to like They want to eat it, taste it, touch it, feel it, sense it. You know, the idea of like, if like you're going to be a blacksmith, the feeling of smiting the hammer and hearing the sounds and knocking up is like, ugh. And I kind of feel like they're probably really good bards and musicians. For that reason, they want to hit the drums and they want to, like, you could see a Nakadama drumming circle, you know, just all jamming out and doing whatever they're doing, just like having a good time.
But I like the idea of them finishing a sword, and it's the worst sword ever in existence, but they're like, oh my gosh, when I was smacking the metal, it was so hot and it was so cool and the heat and it dried out my skin. I had to go get in the water. It was so good. And then they show it and it's like, ugh.
I think they're really like, they live it up. Like Nakadama parties are the best parties. Mm-hmm. You know, Nakadama, they know how to have a good time.
Yeah.
I think the image that came into my head where I'm like, okay, I kind of get the you know, who the Nakadama are, was imagining entering a tavern and it's full of Nakadama and it's everybody croaking and just like kind of croaking laughter and everybody, you know, smashing tankards together, and just, you could just feel the joy in this place.
You're all singing Nakadama songs.
Yeah, kind of red in the cheeks and stuff.
Gosh, that's good. I love that.
And you know, like, it's fun to like think then, you know, that Nakadama had at one time this, you know, this ancient civilization.
Yeah.
And how has it differed? Like, you know, when Nakadama speak of the old days, like, was it sort of this idea that once upon a time, the Nakadama were very sort of stately and regal, and now they're kind of like, they've somehow, that time is over, and now they're just kind of all sort of wanderers and, you know, like...
The way I kind of imagine it is... You know, Nakadama, if you look at maybe like old ruins, they might have had things like fortresses and castles and stuff. But the way I want to picture Nakadama is that they are a people that this older civilization that might have been more warlike, more like a traditional kind of historical society, that they've kind of cast that off. That they, like, the things that matter in life are, you know, a great meal with a good drink with a bunch of friends. Like, that's it. Like, that. If you can have that, you've achieved it.
Makes me think that there was a ruler that dissolved it. Right. Like, that the Nakadama were all like stuffy, huffy.
They
like
abdicate.
Hoity-toities, you know, and they're like, ruff, 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 ruff. And it was all repressed. And then one Nakadama ruler is like, you know what? I've been to the top of the mountain. And I saw the great frog, you know, and it's like, and it just said, dissolve the whole thing.
Yeah.
And we're going to party, you know, like, we're going to have a good time. It's all about, you know, having an awesome experience.
There could also be like humans coming to Obajima for the first time. And it's like, well, there's tension in the air between Nakadamas and humans. And it's like, no, we are going to live harmoniously. Mm. And that's through like dissolving our war efforts and combining.
Wow. Like, were the Nakadama warlike?
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
There's potentially, like, you know, there's the question of like, Nakadama were here first. They had temples and they had their land, and they were the first people to connect with technology and were certainly the most knowledgeable. And then humans arrived and they were like, what's going on here? And I'm not saying the humans were bad necessarily, but whenever there's two factions, there's always a little tension at first, potentially.
I will say that they were warlike only because I want to see statues of frog people with swords.
There it is.
That's it.
Yeah.
That is it.
Yeah. That's cool. Like, cause that would be interesting. Like, you know, you go to this in like ruined temple or this ruined fortress.
Yeah.
And you see, you know, like if you went to like in Egypt and you see Luxor and you see the whole thing of like the Pharaoh, like that did all these cool, and basically all the images are of the Pharaoh kicking ass and doing awesome stuff. And it's like, this could be like the Nakadama version of that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, King Croker the Fourth with the big Nakadama, you know, traditional crown and scepter and, you know,
riding sword. An ancient giant dragon frog.
Yeah. Oh, dude. Yeah. That's it. Like, and, you know, and the, you know, the Nakadama member of the party is like, yeah, I don't know much about that time, but, you know, what a bunch of dummies, you know,
like dude, I can't remember any of that.
Why were they doing anything like that? Why not have a party and have friends, you know? So
my
and
dad worked in a rice field. Like, I don't know what you're trying to say.
At the same time, you might have Nakadama. If I'm playing a Nakadama fighter, and if I'm Nakadama who's there to experience, they're saying like, hey, current Nakadama culture has lost part of the spectrum of experience, which is, you know, the thrill of combat, proving oneself in, you know, in that way. So like, there's still a Nakadama way to approach even things like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's... I'm thinking about like the old German, like the Lichtenauer, like sword techniques, but you could like have an in-world Nakadama treatise, you know, that, about precisely. Sword fighting.
Yes. Yeah.
Where you guys just make a book about sword techniques. I can see it, and I can see it everywhere.
You saw the twinkle in my eye. Twinkle
yeah.
in your eye.
Yeah. And ways to use like the frog leaps. Like yes. you could leap and flip, and then you know, now I'm behind you, you know.
But that the question I have is, and this is kind of interesting, there's not a lot of Nakadama temples left temples or strongholds left on Obajima. In fact, there's none that are currently occupied only by Nakadama. There is the temple of Shrew. It's not the animal Shrew, but I can't remember what it's called. Does anyone remember? Do you have the locations tab open that you can grab?
I don't have it open.
There is a temple. There is a Nakadama temple. But if I remember correctly, it's been fully sunk into a lakeside.
That's correct.
And so that's kind of interesting that I wonder what happened to the Nakadama temples and strongholds when they assimilated into regular life with humans and Dara. Well, eventually Dara, but spirits as well. Did they take it upon themselves to destroy their strongholds and temples to kind of like force themselves into this new lifestyle? Like, what's the reasoning that these are gone?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's interesting too, because the Nakadama, if you were to ask, you know, Nakadama scholars and things like that, the way the Nakadama tend to work is that they are story collectors, but as all good storytellers, because it's about the experience of telling a good story, embellishment is a big part of the process. So what is true? Over time, over generations, there's this game of telephone that happens across history.
Yeah.
And so some people will tell you, you know, that a mighty, you know, frog spirit tore down these, you know, these things.
It's true.
It's
very true.
That they were left derelict, you know, and hidden as a way to protect them. Or, you know, who knows? There are probably as many Nakadama historians as there are that many theories and stories about it's what true. Happened.
They are the ultimate unreliable narrative.
I forgot about the Nakadama and their tall tales, their like experiences and their desire to have the most outlandish and fun and over the top experiences. When they impart stories, they like to embellish them as well. And so because of that, I think that's very true. I guess maybe we'll never know why there's no temples.
A good
temples.
Story is better than a true story.
Very, very true.
The sunken temple of Shum, by
Shum,
the way.
Shum, so close. By the way. Like a shrew.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah,
the sunken temple of Shrew is just, they had one shrew that they worship. There's only one on the island.
Yeah.
The king carried it around.
And only matters to shrews. Like, you know.
There's also something I remember in some of our Nakadama writing, and we reference queens of Nakadama more than we reference kings.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if it's more of a
matrilineal kind of deal.
Yeah. Matriarchy. Like a matriarchy type situation through the Nakadama people. Is that something
there would be something cool with, like, I mean, if Nakadama sort of, you know, like I remember, you know, seeing strings of frog eggs, you know, and it's just this, like, this enormous string, like there could be a theme about that, like visual cue, like when you see those, like, and the idea that the matriarch has these sort of like, maybe their like tapestries are like done in that sort of frog egg looking string, like it's like strings of, you know, the lineage of these Nakadama rulers or whatever.
Maybe there's like maybe more of a maternal, there's almost like a maternal thing going on with the queen, where it's like they're not, the queen is not the mother of every Nakadama, but there's almost like a motherly aspect to it, like that she's taking care of the king, of the people.
Yeah,
in that same sense,
like there's like a lily pad or a pond or some place that's sacred, like a place that's a birthing ground, you know.
Well, we had actually, again, also in the notes for the Temple of Shum. Pardon me, I'll never pronounce it right. The Shrew Temple. we were talking about it being the last breeding ground potentially for Nakadama, or like maybe that breeding grounds are maybe like an outdated thing, but like originally that lake was a place where they'd go and breed. yeah, and leave their tadpoles and mm-hmm. eggs and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about kind of an extension of that is the idea that most established settlements on Obajima might have had origins with Nakodama, like an Akodama settlement first.
Yeah.
And so you might have essentially some sort of body of water or like a pool that's at the center of the settlement. Maybe it's still there, maybe it isn't, that's but like there's this idea.
Yeah,
yeah,
a birthing pool
or just a place, you know, you might have a communal kind of like bathhouse thing yeah. because, you know, in order to, you know, then maybe that's a big part of the way the Nakodama spent their social time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you could have some fun things like that. And that could be an indicator of which settlements kind of are older than other ones
yeah.
that have this kind of this hallmark.
These birthing pools. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super interesting. I like that.
Hatching. Yeah. Hatching grounds or, you know, tadpoles. And
so how long do we even think Nakodama, like we're assuming that like maybe an egg or two that's placed in a pool, not like hundreds of eggs all at once or however, I have no idea, but I don't know, a couple eggs and then placed in a pool and like.
Or do Nakodama homes have them? You know, is there a room in a dwelling?
Yeah.
It might not be, you know, it doesn't have to be such a public affair of just like, how all these young are going to be born. Maybe it's this idea that each home has one of these things. Mm, yeah. And
also, like, you know, there's like these frogs in the Amazon where they actually lay their eggs way up in trees. And there's these plants that kind of catch all the rainwater and they kind of create these mini pools.
Mm.
So maybe some Nakodama actually live in the forest, you know, or they have, you know, like a pool way up in a giant tree that just like that's where this one tribe of Nakodama or this one clan, you know, long ago.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I think maybe, you know, depending where you find Nakodama across the island, you know, there's swamps, there's mm-hmm. the land of hot water, mm-hmm. there's the Gale Fields. Like maybe Nakodama birthing locations are different depending on where you are.
They don't have to be monolithic. And that's what's so fun. If you're playing a Nakodama or you're a DM who wants to, you know, center stories around Nakodama, the idea of them being varied is great.
Right? Yeah.
You might have nomadic river dwellers, you know, that are on boats or whatever, and they kind of go around and you can do some fun stuff.
Almost interesting if there's like some markings that you get like, oh, you were birthed in salt water. We can tell. Yeah. You got some like, you know, like some white stripes down your back or something like that. Cause you were, you know, by the beach or something like that. It's kind of interesting.
I just see like a Nakodama running a tavern by like the sea shore and it's like called the Salty Frog.
Yeah.
And he's just like a brine toad or something.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Okay. But. Well, I feel like we should jump into potentially. I feel like we should talk about some of our concepts for some of their abilities.
Yeah.
So they're amphibious. That's one thing.
Yes. So that means they can use both their left and right hand.
That's right.
I think we jumped on them being amphibious, a walking speed of 25 and a swimming speed of 30 feet. So they're actually a little, at least that's what I have down here. None of this is final. All of this will be changed probably, at least altered a bit. But
they're size small.
They are size small.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're pretty short ones. In fact, I think, well, that's not true because Dara can be, we didn't discuss this in the Dara, but Dara can also be size small.
You choose.
Yeah, yep. You choose. Yeah. But yeah, one of our other small races, the Nakodama, who are fairly short, roughly like 2 to 3 feet tall, 50 pounds. And there's a couple different things. Now, this seems like it might be a little outdated. I initially wrote the Nakodama before bringing Adam and Ari on, and some of the things stayed, but some of them didn't. And so I'd love to talk about some of the abilities that we're thinking about for the Nakodama. Obviously, we talked about being amphibious. There's some kind of dexterous instincts. There's some tools of the trade, but that's kind of a little back when I haven't imagined them kind of like changing lifestyles consistently and all over the place. What do we have on the actual document here? I'm sorry.
They had the healing croak. They had this like healing ability that we were thinking.
Yeah.
Like,
so I have a hot take on that though.
Oh,
I don't know if I like the croak.
Yeah.
I think I prefer the saliva, which is what we originally had discussed.
Okay.
I know that's a little, I think the croak is cool. And I do think having a croak do something is cool.
Yeah.
But I think I prefer, like, I love the idea of a, like, Nakodama running down the street and then being like, wait, and, like, their friend's bleeding out and they go and jump and bite down on their arm and then they heal them through, like, their saliva. I think that's so interesting. And much more interesting than, like, lay on hands or any of the other, like, healing abilities you get. Like, I think, whatever the angel class, angel race is. What are they called?
Azamar.
Oh, the Azamar.
Thank you. They get some healing, some special healing, stuff like that.
So I think that works if, because of their tongue, they have the kind of frog tongue.
Mm.
And then if you could heal, you know, by doing that, that's kind of cool. Just visually, it's neat. The idea of healing saliva could be weird. I mean, that's fine. I mean, you could be weird is not always bad, but the idea of, yeah, I'm not, you know, the idea of Nakodama has to spit or lick someone or bite them to heal. Whereas, like, a croak lets me, like, the reason I liked croak, not that I'm, you know, going to die on this hill or anything, but, like, the idea is I might have a word that I use when I heal someone.
Sure.
I croak this out. Like, that's,
almost like
that's
a
my
healing
thing.
Word?
Almost like a healing word.
Yeah.
So there could be something really interesting that I could make that my own that I like quite a bit.
Also, but tactically, you can do it at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, like my buddies down in the ravine.
Yeah.
And I have to, like, well, now I've got to get down there to, like, spit on him.
A tongue can do it. Like,
yeah, that's true.
But that's still, like, 10 feet. You're not talking about, like, you know, I can't project this, you know, 30 feet away or anything. And maybe that's fine. Like, how powerful does this need to be?
Yeah.
So how about this? Let's put the healing on the background, on the back burner, one might say, and talk about the tongue idea and other things we can do with the tongue. So what about inserting a Legend of Zelda classic into this kind of concept in the hookshot, with the idea that you can shoot out your tongue, attach it to something, and because you're so light, pull your body to that thing.
That's fun.
So, like, 15 feet away, you can, like, hit the side
so
of a wall.
You get extra movement.
Yeah.
Right. And that could be vertical movement as long as there's something to anchor onto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What if I use that against a creature?
I would say if the creature's smaller than you.
Mm-hmm.
You pull it to it.
Okay, see, that's now we're talking about more tactical type of movement. Now, it's harder because you're small.
Right, so it'd have to be
creature. Or, I mean, you could pickpocket.
Right, yeah, you did with objects.
Wow. You know.
I would say it's very much so like a brunt force object. It'd be like, you pull yourself to anything that's larger, or if it's tiny, like a creature, it pulls to you. But I don't think it's like a mage hand type situation.
But if somebody wanted, like, if I wanted to use it against, you know, your soda can, a DM could say you can't do that. But, like, in world, why not?
I would totally say you could as a DM. I'd
absolutely
be like, go for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, but I would make it like you've got a real challenge. And if
you have
up,
to hit it.
Yeah.
So then why not just make the entirety of this character all about their ability to activate and use their tongue?
I think a Nakodama rogue now becomes really cool. Because you could just be chilling, follow your mark. Like, you don't even have to get next to them. You're just like, whoosh, bam, and you hit it with the tongue. And if you're good at it,
I mean, that's more interesting than, you know, leaping a bunch and a bunch of other, like, you know, like there's a handful of different frog options through third party as well as standard, you know, wizard. So why not do something that's not overly utilized?
I think it's totally cool.
It's definitely worth exploring. I think that's cool.
Also, to just be like sitting here and I could just like shoot my tongue, hit the ceiling, and just like,
yeah,
like jet up and
Batman
then
Batman away.
Yeah, yeah, and it could be in the rafters and then I'm like scuttling around, you know, like that would be fun.
Yeah, I dig that.
Or, you know, swing. Like, instead of swinging on the chandelier, I'm like, going across.
Yeah. That's great.
That would be awesome.
So,
yeah.
Why not like a 15 foot distance?
Sweet.
15 foot distance, that seems fairly, not too much, not too little.
Yeah.
10 feet seems a little not as exciting.
No.
You can get over a few gaps. You can get on top of the roof.
Is it part of your movement?
I would say.
Right. Like, if I move.
Is it an action?
So like if I move 25 feet.
Yeah.
Okay, that's my standard. That's what right now, that's what we're saying their move is.
Yeah.
And I want to use my tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm using 15 feet of that. Does that mean I move 10 and then I can use it? Am I taking that away from my move?
I would
or
say
in addition to
if it takes up an action to do so,
Yeah.
Then it's an addition to.
Sure, sure.
If it's a bonus action, which I think it probably could be without being too, because if it's an action, it's kind of useless. No, it's going to be very situational if it's an action. We make it a bonus action. It's a nerfed rogue bonus movement.
But it also gets my fighter in closer to attack, right? Because if I'm let's say attacking a larger creature, like medium sized whatever, because that's going to be the most common use case, is I'm going to be using it to get closer to a thing.
Sure.
So then I'm basically doing this charge move via tongue to then attack you with the, I think it's cool.
I
think it's cool too.
Is it broken that, I mean, I don't know. Let me just try and get this straight in my head. Like I could use my tongue, get in close, hit the person, and then move away out of range. Could I do that?
Yeah, I don't see why you wouldn't be able to. You'd still get an attack of opportunity.
Okay. The tongue
can pull you to a creature or an object that's bigger, you know, like something heavier than you, like a solid object or a creature that's a size above you. But then it also can pull something to it.
Yeah.
So we have a cantrip that does the same thing, essentially. My question is, what is the... I think the difference is whenever you pull an object, there should be a weight limit.
Yeah, I was just going to ask the question.
So if the Nakodama only was 50 pounds, pulling something that's... Maybe it's a weight limit based off of your strength.
Yeah.
That's
great.
If you have a 10 strength, it has to be 5 pounds or less. If you have a 15 strength, it's 10 pounds. I mean,
if a buddy of yours fell off a cliff, could you like snag him with the tongue? Could they swing?
I think you'd just get pulled to them because they're a medium, unless they're a tiny creature.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess if you had a little sprite friend or that the wings got.
But in the same way, that's kind of interesting. Say you're a Nakodama spellcaster and you're like falling and you're like both free and you've, you know, pull yourself to the person, you cast fly and you fly them away or something like that.
Interesting. Yeah.
There's a question about spell casting. Can I cast a touch spell through my tongue?
I don't think so. Cause that extends the 15 feet. I think that's broken.
Yeah.
I think no spells through Nakodama tongues.
So
it's just too broken.
Nakodama tongues then have an anti-magic.
Every part of the Nakodama, it's the saliva cancels out magic.
Right. I don't think you have to acknowledge it.
Yeah,
that's
true. Yeah.
And if that's something that, you know, if you want to house rule that,
yep.
You let us know how broken that gets.
Is up to you. Yeah. Add 15 feet to all touch spells. Let's see how that goes.
Man.
Yeah, that's rough. So, yeah, maybe it's based off of your strength is the weight that you can lift it. I also, and this is kind of hard, to separate it, I'd almost say you need to make a roll for it or something like that. The question is like, you know.
If it's an object, I mean, you still have to roll to hit it, right?
Yeah, well, you do and you don't, right? Like the pull spell, or the spell that we're referencing, it's not pull, I can't remember what it's called. You don't, it just happens. Same with, you guys know what I'm talking about? What's that spell with the hand?
Mage hand.
You can just pick stuff up and move it over, right? You don't need to make an attack.
Yeah.
So making a roll of some sort, like a dex check or a strength check or something like that is kind of interesting target it.
I think an attack roll makes sense. If it's like something like a wall, you know.
A wall you automatically hit. I think with the pull ability specifically, where you pull yourself, again, because maybe if it's just like a certain size, like if it's a medium creature or larger, you automatically hit. If it's anything smaller, including the pull, like if it's a metal bar, you have to roll to hit it. And it's just based off the standard DCs. Easy is a 5, normal's a 10. Difficult to 15, very difficult to 20.
I think it's solvable.
Well, the question is, you're using strength or are you using your dex? Because that's going to affect.
Is it a finesse weapon?
Is it a finesse? how, where? I mean, because in my immediate thought, it's a dex, because this is like the core of dex is like you aiming things.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So, but that's going to make, when you guys said, fighters and barbarians, it's going to make them slightly less potent. Nakodama are slightly less potent fighters and barbarians by making it dex only.
But I mean, it's like the idea of the weight that you can carry or that you can pull with your tongue then can still trigger off a strength like you.
Yeah.
Then so you've got that part going for you. But yeah, you're right. I think
it's interesting. There's a little bit of weapon. There's a couple different things there.
It's like because it's not like a bow. The idea that, you know, if you're strong, you can pull back a heavier pound bow.
Right.
but this isn't that.
Yeah.
I was thinking also going back to, you know, the idea of Nakadama's tongues not being able to do touch spells. But what if there was some kind of, I don't know if it would be a feat or something, but that's just special to Nakadama's. Like at some point you get like the shocking tongue or something.
Right.
You can just go bzzz and zap somebody with a spell using your tongue.
You could do something like you can cast, and well, how many touch cantrips are there? You could limit it. You could be like first level spells and lower.
Yeah.
You can tell you right touch. Now.
Yeah. Hey, let us consult.
I know shock and grasp was one of them. Yeah. I know
chilling touch.
And then if you go to first level spells, you get things like cure wounds, which all of a sudden is a 15-foot reach, which is significantly better.
But then I think that could get back to the healing saliva, healing croak, you know, like Nakadama do have that healing ability, but now it's like,
well, or we cut that.
I think we'd have to cut it for all of this, because with pulling yourself and pulling objects, I think that's like the core of Nakadama.
Yeah.
And them being amphibious, I think that's everything you need. Plus, they have their skills and all the other stuff. Yeah.
Cantrip.
The question, though, you know, not to say I don't want to give a standing leap. I do.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also like, how many abilities are we going to give these people?
It's weird because like standing leap and then using your tongue to go up, you know, or swing, it plays in similar space, right? It's getting over objects. But if I have a frog person that doesn't have a standing leap, I feel like that.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting because standing leaps are fully based off of your strength.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, a dex-based rogue is going to have a terrible standing leap.
Mm.
Unless you give it a core, Nakadama all have a standing leap of 15 feet no matter what.
Yeah.
Which we could. That's not broken enough, and we could just toss it in there.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's cool. We'll do that. We can throw that in there. We'll play around with that feat. We'll have a feat episode where we can talk about Nakadama specific feats. I feel like we're pretty darn close for the Nakadama.
Yeah. Like, what else is there to cover?
I don't think there's much of anything. Yeah, we understand their age. Oh, I guess, have we talked about their age?
No.
They live to roughly 45, and they're adults by 12.
Live fast, die young.
Live fast, die young. Yeah. Yep. Nakadama has always said they have, each one of them comes with a tattoo.
I just can see the Nakadama memes coming in now.
Yeah, exactly. We've talked about their size. We've talked about their speed. They're amphibious. And I think that's it. I mean, based off of that tongue replacement, we get rid of all the other abilities.
It's cool.
And that tongue's cool. It's very fun.
It's going to be fun.
It's an appendage. Not a lot of races get appendages.
Yeah.
Appendages.
It's almost like a prehensile tail or something like that. Like, no one else has that.
Did the problematic race from Spell Jammer have that?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah.
Seriously.
There's the Luxodon.
Luxodon's cool with the trunk. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Couldn't the Tabaxi have like a something with a tail? I don't know. Someone in the comments tell us if we're wrong. Yeah. But that being said, I would love to, because I think we've got enough time to jump into backgrounds. To fill on our promise of getting to backgrounds. There's a brief while in which we're like, are we going to make this happen? So we got the basics of Nakadama. Let's jump into backgrounds for us. The question is...
Bum, bum, bum.
The question is, what backgrounds do we want to include? What things are pertinent enough for us to throw in there? And there's also some specifications on factions as well. Because we also are planning on adding in boons that you get from joining factions. But you don't often start as part of a faction. It's more of a something you earn.
Yeah.
Because gaining or being a part of these factions, there's usually weight behind them. And it's not normally something a first level adventurer has.
Yeah.
And if they are part of a faction, and maybe this is one of our backgrounds, is faction acolyte. Where it's like you're maybe a member of one of these things, but without the full benefits.
Mm.
So you gain certain things, but not everything.
Yeah.
How do we feel about that? Acolyte might not be the right word, but it's darn close.
Apprentice.
Yeah, I mean, there's something really cool about that. Like, you know, you have your coven apprentice or
apprentice acolyte, is great.
Or you have, you know,
apprentice to the League of the Underwater Explorers. I forget what we call them.
Extraordinary Men.
Yeah, that's right. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Yeah,
that's what it was. Was that your Sean Connery?
Yeah, that was Mr. Goldfinger.
I suddenly remember my Charlemagne.
That's right.
It's my favorite line in that whole movie.
That's crazy. Let's do the rest of this podcast as Sean Connery. So that's interesting. I like that. I like a faction acolyte slash apprentice, and we can even be vague enough in it. So it's like, pick a faction that you want to be a part of. You're not a full-fledged member, but you are a apprentice of someone who is. Yeah. Which is very cool.
So there's a faction that is actually geared toward, it's like a scouts. There's the Society of Young Stewards. Mm. So this is kind of like your Boy Scout or Girl Scout kind of thing, which wouldn't be a faction as an adventurer, but this might have been your background.
Yeah.
Grew up in this kind of thing.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
So that can be a fun one.
Yeah.
That's neat because it builds in the idea that for one, that you're already committed to, you know, being a good citizen of Obojima, whatever that means. But then on top of it, you've studied some skills.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your outdoorsy skills, your orienteering, mountaineering, whatever it was that you did while you're on this thing. And also it could also say that, you know, some cool areas that maybe other, you know, like, most players in Obojima, they're going to start off, you know, in the little sheltered village, and you know, the outside world is kind of like, well, what's beyond that, the horizon hill, we don't know, but this background might know something.
Yeah.
You might just be able to roll on a table and you've got one cool clue, you know, like your scoutmaster or whatever took you on an adventure and you went up and you camped out on that mountain way over there, and you know, and also like the scouts kind of tell tales and legends, you know, you sit around the campfire at night and somebody's going to tell you the tale and they're going to come out and say, oh, did you hear about, you know, old Lumpy Threefoot, you know, and
you hear about Russell. He got trapped in a house with an old man covered in balloons.
Yeah, exactly.
He got lost for a year and a half, came back with a bunch of scars and a giant dead ostrich.
Yeah. And it's like, I was like, wow, where'd that take place? Okay, well, let's go figure it out, you know? Or, you know, the Dara, you know, like the Dara Scoutmaster that's just telling you, you know, some crazy story about like going wandering off in the woods. And so, yeah, you know, you could get like right there, you've got your kind of quest to start.
Yeah. I just thought of something really interesting.
Yeah.
What if you found someone as a Dara with a Dara glyph on their forehead?
Whoa.
Like, when was this? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, because again, they can't see it.
Yeah.
So it's just like, what do you do as a Dara in that situation? Like, excuse me, ma'am, I need to touch your head.
Yeah.
She's like, get off me.
Yeah.
It has no idea how it got there, when that happened.
That's a question. Like, can they only do it, you know, put the glyphs on trees? Is there a connection to trees in that way?
Yeah.
Or you like, you think this person's like, you know, was like camping in the woods and they were asleep and a dying Dara came up, touched their forehead, and just like,
that's pretty crazy.
And then, you know, and then just like went and dematerialized, or however Dara.
Oh, that's such an interesting, again, with the motherly instinct to be born next to where your Dara glyph was on a human.
Whoa.
And then all of a sudden that's your family.
You imprint on that person.
That's so interesting.
That's interesting.
Whoa.
Okay, that's side. Sorry, everyone. Side topic. Watch the Dara video if you haven't already, or a Dara episode. I was gonna say something else, but I can't remember what. Oh yeah. What do you guys think of like a scavenger, background, like a scrapper? Maybe scavenger seems a little too post-apocalyptic. But like a scrapper,
a salvager.
Yeah. Someone who goes and like finds some old tech and old motors, and
they
like,
collect this stuff.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, that's neat.
Maybe they get like advantage on, you know, history or, you know, certain intelligence checks based on machines and things like that.
Yeah. Like what's Arcana in this world? Like, is that knowing sort of a little bit more than the average person about what the 1980, you know, 80s tech is? And maybe, you know, it's sort of the in-world explanation of what those things are. It's not like what they actually are.
Okay, this is gonna, again, not to derail this again, sorry everyone listening, how do we feel, I know this sucks, how do we feel about adding another skill? How does everyone feel about that?
Sounds fun.
Because like I feel like we could pigeonhole mechanics into its own thing, or into one of the other classes or one of the other skill sets, like intelligence or something like that. Or we could just get into it and make mechanics its own skill, where it's like, yeah, you understand. Like there's two ways to operate machines in this world, right? There's fixing them, like the old man at the airfield, and then there's enchanting them.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
but that's magical, right? So I think the moment you start saying it's mechanics, that's telling me that I understand schematics and that I understand the engineering behind these things. And so, but if it's magical and it's like it's spirits that are being used to power these things because, you know, there's no infrastructure for, you know, an electrical grid or whatever in Obajima. So if it's the idea that spirits are the source of power here, then it is magical by nature, right? But
don't you think that there are non-magical machines in here? Like, for example, kids riding around on bikes don't need to imbue them with magic. And there's gear systems in there.
Yeah.
Our hot air machines and our gliders.
Things that are purely mechanical, not necessarily electrical.
So is it things like tech that ran on electricity, now Obajimas have no concept of electricity, but they do have concept of lightning bolt, and they do have concept of spirits entering a machine. So spirits can act as electricity in this world.
Right. Cause there's kind of like we have a modern understanding of technology where it's like, there's a computer chip in here running the show.
Yeah.
But there's also like, you know, we're not modern technology. We're 80s technology where it's like, you know, there's certain things that are just like, these are just, you turn this on and gears turn. And that's something that a person from Obajima could comprehend.
Yeah.
And so there's almost something that, like, I could see someone destroying a K-truck, taking all the gears and metal pieces, and then making it like a Rube Goldberg machine at their house or something kind of, like that. Yeah. You know, like
crazy golem.
So the real question for us, and maybe this is a broader conversation that I'm now realizing we have to have, is what does non-magical machinery look like? We also talked about machines in our industrial town. Mm-hmm. They're running on train rails and things like that. Where is that? Are pulley systems?
I think if you do a mechanic skill in this world, it has to be in world. It has to be not mechanics as we know it, but I think it has to be mechanics in what Obajimans make.
Then maybe contraptions is a better way of saying it.
Or like an arcanist. Or I mean,
an artificer?
Artificer.
Yeah. I think artificer is something we have to avoid, though.
Yeah, yeah, we have to avoid that. But it's that kind of thing. It's like somebody who takes a bunch of metal pieces and parts,
right,
assembles it together in such a way, but non-magically.
And it has to be a thing where the DM doesn't also have to be an engineer to check their work. Yeah. You know, like, did you actually make the bike that you, you know, or the
I guess clock? It's just sort of like, did you make the roll? Like, I mean, like if somebody's like, I took apart a K truck and I took apart a bicycle and I want to make this like a machine that, I can, pedal, but also it's got a swinging arm I can hit things with and do damage. It's like, all right, that's, you know, DC 15, go for it. You're at disadvantage. And they go, and like, nah, 20. Okay, sweet. You did it.
Well, then what about a removing mechanics and adding like a scavenge style skill set where you have an understanding of these 80s machines and being able to take them apart and getting the things you need. Mm-hmm. And then in that same regard, you could almost utilize, and maybe scavenge isn't the right word, but you can almost utilize it to like, comprehend what's going on in these machines. Because another thing we haven't talked about is like certain machines at certain levels can't be imbued with magic to turn on, right? If they're so junky, they're just junk now. Mm-hmm. But can you fix it? Can you get it to the level where, and that's something that I don't know that we've discussed.
I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of mechanical in the game sense. There might be a lot there to unpack if that's a route we want to go down.
Well, I guess it's kind of the same level of like survival. It covers so many things. So we might just give you a term to utilize because people will most likely want to do it. So giving you a skill and letting the DM's discretion go through it, because survival, I could say the exact same thing with survival. I go and make a complicated trap to trap this giant bear. Yeah. And it's like, do you know how to make a trap? Like, how? I just have you make a roll, and then all of a sudden you roll a dat 20, yeah, and you have a giant bear cage that you spend all day chopping down. Yeah. So we can kind of go through the same thing with all skills. And I think skills are just meant to encompass these broad terms that we can't mechanically flesh out enough.
I mean, is scavenge or mechanic like kind of this catch-all thing where it's like, I just want to do a thing, DM. Like, I want to make a thing that when the giant walks down this path, I've got springs and a steel shank and all that, and it's going to shoot a crossbow bolt. Can I do that? And the DM's like, make your mechanic roll, you know, or like, I want to make that thing, but I see this like old wrecked K truck. DM's like, make a scavenge roll. And you scavenge and you're like, yes, I did it. And DM's like, all right, great. You've got those parts to make that thing if you want to do it. Now to make that thing, I have to do some other skill check.
Right.
I think that works.
I think, yeah, the question, players will want to do this. So my question is, are we going to encompass that? Is everything going to be under just straight intelligence checks? Or do we make a skill based around it? Or survival checks? You know, does survival encompass going through and breaking down machine parts?
Yeah.
It's interesting. And I don't think there's current, I think players will want to do it. Yep. And I think we'll need to figure out what that looks like. If it's just skills or if it's a deeper mechanic system.
Yeah. I mean, we've had chats like Ariel bring up the idea of like the idea where, you know, games where resources are scarce. So you're counting your arrows.
Right.
Like when you shoot an arrow, it's like, okay, now I've got 8 arrows. And it matters. And if I run out of arrows, then I've got to know how to get a tree and carve a shaft and fletch it and then tie on and like flint nap my arrowhead and then tie it on and like make a legit arrow. So those are all skill checks I've got to do. Is this a game where that now becomes a thing that we do in Obojima? It's like, it really matters now when you walk by an abandoned place and you see a wrecked piece of equipment, you're like, oh, we got to scavenge that. Like,
to me, it comes down to what is the emphasis of what is, obviously players are going to do what they're going to want to do.
Yeah.
But what does the setting want to emphasize? The more weight you put on the spiciness of the tech, the more the game will become about that.
Right.
It's not necessarily wrong. But it's just one of those things. Okay. So if the idea is this tech is here as a resource for me to play with,
yeah,
as opposed to the way it's used. Like we talked about the idea of, you know, a mage's spell book might be a portable cassette player.
Right.
Right. And they're casting their spells through the tape in the cassette player. So that's not them making a mechanics check.
Right.
They're using this tech in a way that is still very D&D.
Yeah. Right? Spell component.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or, you know, a way to cast your spells. And so if we want to say, well, you can use the machinery in a way that is mundane machinery, that's totally reasonable because people are going to want to do that. They're going to want to make the things Adam is talking about. But again, like the more the book discusses that, the more the game is about that.
If sure.
That makes sense.
I think what I'm at least referencing is players will want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the moment we're giving... I think giving no answer is worse than giving.
Yeah, sure. Some guidance,
something.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I would suggest is like making either a skill or saying or tying it to an existing skill, and then saying giving like a paragraph describing on how you might do it, like, you know, if people want to interact with scavenging, this is how you'd scavenge. Like for example, in our based off of what we said, what is the old man in the airfield even doing?
Yeah.
If he can, he should just get a wizard over here to enchant plane.
Yeah.
You know, if he's not building it back up, if he's not looking for spark plugs, what is he doing? Why can he do it and I can't?
Yeah. Like, and that begs the question, like, is there, like, I think you'd mentioned earlier, like, is there a point where even if a spirit inhabits this thing, it doesn't do any good?
Right.
Like, this thing's junked beyond thing. But so if you had the empty fuselage of an airplane, but no engine in it. Like there's nothing for a spirit to inhabit. There's no electrical system. Mm-hmm. So the spirit isn't able to do anything. So that way now it's a mechanical problem. So then scavenging and having a mechanic skill would then come in really handy. Yeah. And that's what it would take to solve that problem. But as soon as we say there's a scavenging ability, there's a mechanic ability, to Ari's point, now players are going to be like, oh, that's what we do. We find all the ruined stuff. We go and collect all the stuff. We get all this thing. And then it's like, in say we write an adventure and you've got your wrecked airplane or your wrecked, you know, motorcycle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, in like say Zelda, when you hit the broken robot and all these pieces and parts pop out, yeah. Like, do we say, from this wrecked motorcycle, you get one spring, one spark plug, one thing, and like, or do you say you get four mechanical parts, and yeah. From four mechanical parts, you can add that to your role, your mechanics role, to make whatever the heck you want.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's I don't know either.
Yeah,
I don't know either. I think it comes down to each individual table.
Yeah, yeah.
And the answer is we have to come up with some answer, but what the answer is, I'm not positive on what the right one, what the right move is.
I think we suggest it and we say, hey, DM, if you want to go and make your own mechanic system and go in deep and say, yes, when all these things that you find, I'm going to put, these are the objects you find from it. These are the things you can make from those. Great. Cool. Yeah. Do it. And then make that thing and then please share it with the community so everybody can enjoy it. But I think we should say, yes, you have a scavenge ability that helps. If you roll great on your scavenge, you get, you know, you can make a cool thing. Yeah.
And you know, you can forage for food, right? You can forage for resources. And that's one of the ways you can get potion ingredients. Mm-hmm. Some of those ingredients are mechanical,
right?
Right. They're not, naturally occurring. And so the idea of having a skill that then also encompasses the equivalent of foraging for those types of potion ingredients is also great.
Right? Yeah.
That's another thing. So.
Because that is, yeah, that's another thing we're having to define is like there are all kinds of objects, natural objects on Obojima. Some of those, however, are potion ingredients. And what's the distinction? Like if you're like, hey, as a player, how do I know the difference between this, you know, this crab claw and this snail shell? Well, yeah. The snail shell can be used to make a potion. The crab claw, nothing, yeah. You know.
It's worthless.
Yeah.
You know like, what I think? I think we have a lot to figure out, everyone. And this is something we'll discuss and come to a conclusion on. But I can tell you this much, not to cut you off. But we've been recording for a long time, and we're getting sleepy.
we drifted far away from backgrounds.
We drifted so far away from backgrounds. If we have not come up with a conclusion on some of these backgrounds, we'll jump back on them later. That being said, I love the apprentice. I love the scrapper, and yeah. I'm sure we can find a few other things. But for now, this is the wrap up of this episode. This has been Sleepy Ari, Sleepy Adam, and Tired Jeremiah. Briefly discussing something that's going to be a headache for us later.
We've been wearing the same clothes for many episodes.
It's like we just wandered into this cornfield. You know?
Go ahead and follow us on Discord or whatever, how that works, and YouTube and things like that. And we'll talk to you all in the next episode, probably in new clothing. Bye.